Hello, everyone, and welcome to a Friends with Fantasy Benefits Concept podcast. I am Chuck Anderson. I can be reached at Just Chucking It. We have our friend from the Great Up Norte, Andrew Dewhurst, with us, who I earlier called a Canuck in passing. Do you get called a Canuck frequently, Andrew?
No, I don't think Canadians are typically walking around calling each other Canucks.
Is that because Vancouver didn't have a good hockey team, or is that because that's only people in Vancouver?
No. It's a generalized term, like nickname, but it's not. It'd be like you walking around calling everyone you know a Yankee.
Well, since we're baseball people, and we, you know, and I live in Milwaukee, we would hate that, since we don't have, we're overly jealous of Yankee privilege, if you will. Okay, Andrew. Give us your Twitter handle here, quick.
You can find me at Andrew K. Dewhurst.
All right. Our friend Paul the Martin, not the Martian, Paul the Martin, is our makeshift last-second fill-in here because we had somebody drop out at right at the wire here. So, Paul, we're going to throw you under the bus a little bit today. Give us your actual Twitter handle, and then let us go from there.
Yeah. My actual Twitter handle is at Paul the Martin. You can go out there and follow me. I have a Prospects of the Week post that's going up later today. I suppose, like, by the time that this this podcast goes out, that'll be out, and that's over on Prospects 1500. I'll be doing the podcast here, and then Razzball, and I'm everywhere. So you could just go on Twitter and just follow me there, and everything is there.
Perfect. Well, Paul had the unfortunate happenings to have to be with me at one of my most annoying moments, something that I knew I was going to be up on the soapbox on. And today is no better, Paul. It really is not. The good news is that Paul didn't have a whole lot of time to digest exactly how annoying I could be on this topic. So let's get into it right away, and that way these guys can debunk one of my base theories. I think they're more than capable of doing that. All right, the concept for the week was stated to my analysts as all stats can be used to fit a narrative, and that narrative can be inherently skewed. I believe that we decide through the prospect status and through the first few starts of a pitcher what a pitcher is. And I'm going to use Eno Saris as one of the experts, because I miss Eno working more than he does these days, and he's probably the person in this industry that I haven't met that I would most like to meet. So we'll use Eno Saris. Eno Saris decides that Matt Boyd is a bad pitcher because his preliminary stats, when he's, you know, his stats leading up to his Major League service time don't look especially good, and he's got flaws in his game, so Matt Boyd is a bad pitcher. So when we go to look for Matt Boyd, we have that in our head, and we are using the stats to add to what we already believe, otherwise known as a narrative. Like, why is Matt Boyd bad? Not how is Matt Boyd succeeding, how is Matt Boyd possibly good, but boy, Matt Boyd is bad. I mean, that I fully believe that this happens within the industry to a wild extent. And I picked out players, both hitters and pitchers, because it happens for hitters as well. You know, I'm going to ask the question later in the show, give you a little preview. What is the difference? Why did we think that Cody Bellinger was not going to recover, but for five straight years leading up to his late 30s, we've assumed that Edwin Encarnacion is going to recover? So I'm going to ask different questions about how we form narratives and point to what I see in the flaws within this process. What do you think of this concept, Andrew?
I think it's very telling on, like, how people approach players and, like, the bias that we create for players based on analysts' talk, or, like, that group think that occurs. So I think it's a good topic. Be interesting to talk about.
Well, I'll tell you, one of my favorite little aspects of this is pitch values. I hear a lot of people, especially Paul's buddy over at the pitch or at the pitcher list. I hear him all the time talk about, well, this pitch value and this pitch value. Well, guess what? Somehow or another, the pitch values of Matt Boyd add up to a 3.2 ERA. Somehow or another. And like now we've got a dozen starts. It's not like, oh, well, he got lucky for two starts. Like we have a dozen starts that say that he equaled a 3.2 ERA. Well, he's got to have pitch. Something has to be working. Right? I mean, he doesn't have great defense behind him. I mean, half their team's been hurt most of the year. You know, even when Miguel Cabrera's not hurt, he probably shouldn't be playing first base. You know, I mean, so what's Nick Castellanos isn't a good right fielder. So we can point to all these different things and say he's overcoming a lot to have a 3.2 ERA for 12 starts. Paul, what do you think of this topic?
The topic or Matt Boyd specifically? Because I feel like we're just using this to talk about Matt Boyd, who I love, by the way. But I don't know, man. I totally agree. You know, me and Walter, my co-host Walter on the Real Fake Baseball podcast, we talk about this all the time and how stats can really just kind of blind your thinking, but also the narrative can, like what you're saying with Edwin Encarnacion. Like, why do we just think that he's going to turn it around? And there's not just him, but there's plenty of examples of players that, you know, probably should turn it around or can turn it around. And you have to actually look at the numbers to figure out which ones are just a mirage. And I don't think that's Edwin this year, but yeah, I don't know. You know, forming the narratives, all this. I'm kind of excited to see where this is going because I didn't even really get the topic before. So I'm ready to hear where this path leads us.
Okay, well, I picked a player that I thought, to lead off the conversation, that I thought was really fascinating when you're talking about narratives. And that player is Jay Happ. Jay Happ has transformed himself, seemingly, three or four times within his career. There's been the narrative that he was all a junk ball thrower that eventually was going to get caught up to. Then after 3 years of relative success, we said, well, you know, this is just who Jay Happ is. And then all of a sudden, now he's added strikeouts later. You know, I wonder what the narrative is now with Jay Happ. Like right now going forward, is the Jay Happ narrative like, ooh, he's a pitcher who's going to get paid too much next offseason because he's going to be a free agent? Is the narrative, this is a guy that can adjust to what hitters are trying to do to him? What do you think on this topic, Paul? What do you think the narrative is for Jay Happ?
Well, you know what? First of all, I love the narrative of those pitchers where it's just like you take Jay Happ at the end of your draft and you know what you're going to get. Because then that always, to me, means that there is room for improvement. Like you said, with J.A. Happ, this year he is adding strikeouts. He's getting a ridiculous amount of whiffs on the sinker this year, and I would like to dig a little bit more into that. I don't know if it's sustainable or not, but the fastball has always been really good for him, and I feel that there was always a next level for a guy like him who, you know, can throw that breaker right off the table, and he can throw that high fastball from the left side and get that right by you. So, you know, with all of these changing narratives in today's game where like it's almost a narrative in itself that pitchers will change, adding a pitch or you know, changing up their pitch mix or this and that. So I think that, you know, with today's narrative of everyone is constantly evolving, J.A. Happ was a good bet to go into the season and continue that stretch of success that he's had in the past, but also potentially crack some more upside into, you know, where he is now, which I don't know if it's completely sustainable, but there is something to like about what he's doing for sure.
You know, and like you also have a 35-year-old pitcher here, and there's always going to be the story that a 35-year-old pitcher is very likely he's going to hit the wall in the next 6 months is the presumption that is made for someone who's pitching at this level. At this age. Andrew, what are your thoughts on Jay Happ?
Well, there's some interesting things. I just want to add to what you even just said is like, do we think of a 35-year-old as going to hit the wall in the next 6 months, but did we think about this as a 34-year-old Like, where do we draw the line on, like, you're too old versus you're still old enough? Because he's, I mean, when you review, like, last year he still hit 145.1 innings. That's okay. Like, that's going to be a probably, like, that's going to probably qualify you for the ERA title this year. And at 33 through 195 innings. So, I think that's part of, like, the implied narrative is that we start looking at age and being like, well, this wall's there, right? He's going to run into it. Like, he's going to see that wall and run flat into this thing. The other thing that's interesting with Jay Happ is that, like, his fastball velocity is better now at 35 than it was when he was 28 or 29. Like, he actually has the highest average fastball velocity of, like, second highest fastball velocity of his career right now at age 35. So, I mean, age is not necessarily the barrier we want it to be. It's a young, like, I think we all kind of acknowledge it's a young man's game, but, you know, there are pieces that are added with maturity, right? You know, throwing the hardest is not going to bring you the most success, but knowing where to throw it and the sequencing of those events is often what does lead to success. So, I mean, overall, like, Jay Happ's been fantastic. Like, as a guy that you were getting in, like, the 200 to 300 range, you know, you're not certainly not complaining about the, you know, the 10.43 K per nine, or the 3.71 ERA that you're getting out of, you know, somebody who pitches in the AL East. So, everything he's doing right now looks pretty sustainable, and, you know, it'll be interesting to see where he lands actually in the next few months, because he is almost certain to be moved.
Well, there's also some pitchers that are considered to be guile. They pitch on guile, and these pitchers will run into stretches of good strikeouts that are not necessarily sustainable. I think of Tanner Roark, you know, having his, you know, his breakout game here or there. And part of the point is that you didn't draft him for these strikeouts anyway. So really the strikeouts are just a bonus in the big picture. It is also really interesting to note that when you look down a career chart for a pitcher like Jay Happ, his FIP has been all over the board, like a point and a half over his ERA to right at his ERA to under his ERA. And it just really goes to show you the rest of his peripheral numbers look almost identical to what we usually see. His control is even a little bit better than it's been most of his career. But at the same time, the jump in strikeouts takes him from a guy who's pitching very well, whose FIP and XFIP are even better, and most of his career, his FIP and his XFIP have been right at his performance level, or there was indicators that he was going to get worse. Right now, the indicators are that he's probably going to stay the same or get better, which is especially comforting to Jay Happ owners right now, especially with the uncertainty that is going on in Toronto. All right, well, I used the guy as an intro example, and now we have to talk about him. And that is Matt Boyd, the 27-year-old pitcher for the Detroit Tigers. He has the conundrum going on that he has 9 of 12 starts where he's had 3 earned runs or less, and he has 6 of 12 starts where he's had 3 walks or more, which is maybe where a lot of the pessimism comes from Matt Boyd. But I want to throw out there that there's no reason for us to think that Matt Boyd couldn't get better. There's also reason to think when a player enters MLB really into sort of the prime of his career, okay, this is your gig. We know this is your gig and this is where you're going to be. The comfort that Matt Boyd should have right now in, you know, a transforming Detroit Tiger rotation. Wouldn't it be possible that we could say that, wow, this works out really great for Matt Boyd, because while he's really sustaining major league viability, he is enjoying success at the same time. Like, this could be inherently good for Matt Boyd's growth, that he is pitching well, gaining confidence at the major league level. What do you think about Matt Boyd, and what do you think about this preconception that most of the industry has had that Matt Boyd is a bad pitcher? Do you agree with me? Is that the narrative that you thought going into this, Andrew?
I totally understand why people want to say Matt Boyd is a bad pitcher. I mean, like, when you look at his statistics, you like, the thing that you don't understand is, you know, how is his ERA at 3.2? Because he's had a lot of things go his way. Like, his BABIP's sitting at, like, 0.232, which is, you know, nearly 100 points lower than it was the year previous. So he's had some luck there. Like, he's giving up, like, almost 50% fly balls, which is not the typical recipe of success. You know, less, like, he's essentially lost 8% from last year on ground balls and turned them all into fly balls. And it is not, and it has actually caused his ERA to improve. That's not typically a success story. I mean, he's giving up more hard contact, marginally more hard contact than last year. I mean, everything points to, like, statistically speaking, that he should be doing what he did last year, which is a 5.25 ERA. So, I mean, like, I understand, like, the at the end of the day, results are results. The statistics are only things that we read to try to understand them. So I definitely get that portion of it. But, like, regression's coming. I mean, good for Matt Boyd. He's taking advantage of an opportunity. I mean, he's already made almost half the amount of starts he did last year. And there's no reason at this point for Detroit to care. Like, should his ERA get up to 5.25, I think he's still going to be starting every fifth day. So I think he's kind of going to come back down to earth. But until he does, it's a win, right?
So you would be of the school of thinking that Matt Boyd is not going to turn into a better pitcher. I mean, which I couldn't blame you for thinking that.
So, like, I've yet to see anything that tells me that Matt Boyd is improving as a pitcher. Like, the advantages that Matt Boyd has is he's left-handed. Like, he doesn't have a ton of velocity. We haven't seen gains there. We've actually seen it decline. Like, his fastball velocity is down 2 miles an hour. Sinker velocity's down 2.5 miles an hour. Like, everything's down across the board. Slider's down, like, 5. Like, it's all kind of moved in scale. I mean, not that I think the difference between a 92 and a 90-mile-an-hour fastball is that different to the batter, but I just don't see a reason to believe that we're going to see some, like, great improvement.
Okay, well, my job here is for devil's advocacy. In the last two stints in AAA for Matt Boyd, 2.25 ERA, 2.82 ERA, 9.35 Ks per 9, 8.02 Ks per 9. And both of those stints were up over 50 innings. Could this narrative have been spun differently? Is what I'm going to try and present to Paul here, that this is a guy who has had so much success at AAA, and he's just learning how to translate that into major league success. And we have the bonus that he hasn't taken the usual bumps and bruises that maybe his peripherals say he should have taken to get to this point. There, that's my alternative narrative on Matt Boyd. What do you think about that, Paul?
Well, I think there is an actual narrative on Matt Boyd in that he was working with pitching coach Rich Doobie last year, and they were talking about him switching up his arm slot, sort of in the way that Rich Hill was doing over for LA. Obviously, we know the success that that brought him, whether or not he can actually fulfill that in a season probably will never happen. But Matt Boyd is here and he's doing it. Dropped his velo, obviously. He's down to like 88 to 89. But everything is getting more movement. His fastball, his sinker, his changeup, his curveball, his slider. Every single pitch is getting just a little bit more dip, a little bit more horizontal movement. And you know what? Sometimes that's all it takes because, like you said, nothing is really different. The only thing that I could really see is like his chase rate is down, but people are making less contact on the pitches that are going outside of the zone. And that could have something to do with more movement on those pitches. If they are moving away from the barrel more severely, people are obviously going to swing and miss a lot more. So his chase contact was always really high just because his pitches didn't get much movement. And now with the arm slot changes, if he even makes some more improvements, that could bring even more success. But right now, with a little bit more movement in the pitches, maybe he's not this good, but I think he is a little bit better than we think. And his pitch mix is changing too. Obviously, he's throwing the slider more than any other pitch right now. He's never done that before. He was a majority fastball guy, but everything is just a little bit different for Matt Boyd. So this could go either two ways. I mean, one, he could just continue to get better, or he could fall off the face of the earth. But I would like to believe that he's just going to continue to improve. I mean, he's just starting this this mechanical shift, this pitch mix shift. So sometimes you got to let him get going. And like you said, he hasn't taken the bumps and bruises just yet. So maybe he could just kind of continue this. It's almost like Jake Junis, you know, like he hasn't taken the bumps and bruises yet, and he could just continue to improve. So yeah, I would like to comp him to someone like that.
Yeah, I mean, I'm really glad that you presented it this way, because there is always something. Every pitcher is trying to tweak something, and they're trying to improve and evolve within the different approaches that hitters are taking to them, you know, which we've seen a lot, people talking about throwing the high fastball and throwing the slider now, because the slot, you know, the any pitch that completely dives downward, that everyone is trying to launch angle up in through the sky, is going to be very difficult to do anything but ground out on or make really poor contact with, and lots of swings and whiffs up in the zone. I remember when pitchers just pitched down and down and down and down, and that was very down and outside, down and outside, down and outside. And now, because of the launch angle revolution, we have this this jockeying back and forth between pitcher and hitter. And so I'm really glad that Paul presented a different way of looking at the exact same pitcher. And what Andrew presented isn't less true than what Paul presented. And, you know, I mean, Paul, you know, threw in the caveat rightfully that because these adjustments are going on, that perhaps Matt Boyd does stink. I mean, we really don't know. The one advantage I want to mention here is that being in like an 18-team league, you get in trouble in pitching early, and all of a sudden you go, well, this guy's pitching pretty well. I really don't have a choice. So you put him in there. Okay. So I put in Matt Boyd. And now in, you know, a 10-team league, I wouldn't own Matt Boyd. But the point being is that a lot of times these results guys in deeper leagues, you learn more about them. You know, it adds to the breadth of your knowledge about the player base. It's also important, and we didn't even mention it here, that Matt Boyd is a lefty. And it has been traditionally more common for lefties to pitch in the 88 to 90 mile an hour range than it's been for righties, just because obviously even at the major league level, hitters face far more righties than they do lefties. And, you know, and lefties have the advantage of generally having a much better chance of dominating hitters from their own side of the plate than righties do. You know, lefty batters don't face as many good lefty pitchers in the minors. That is the ongoing story for baseball, and has been forever. Well, let's talk about, you know, and we are going to get to some hitters here, I promise, but let's talk about Joe Musgrove, who I find fascinating as well. And I can almost lump Joe Musgrove in with Carlos Rodon, with a slight difference. Carlos Rodon is a guy who has never had below a 1.35 whip. Yet, because he was an elite pitcher at North Carolina State and he was Trey Turner's teammate, like, he is going to be a stud. That's been the narrative over and over and over again. We're just waiting for Carlos Rodon to break out. Joe Musgrove, on the other hand, is a guy who had much less fanfare as a prospect, but then rocketed through the prospect chart later in his minor league career. And, you know, after one bad stint in the majors, Joe Musgrove was written off and drafted really, really late this year. So I sort of want to do a compare and contrast between these two players. So what do you think about the opposing narratives of Carlos Rodon and Joe Musgrove, and who would you rather own going forward, Paul?
Well, I mean, Carlos Rodon to me just has a little bit more upside. I mean, those pitches, like we were just talking about it with Matt Boyd, and Matt Boyd does it at 88 miles an hour, but that high fastball, that breaker that Carlos Rodon brings to the table is, I mean, it's top of the line sort of stuff. Whereas Joe Musgrove, I mean, he brings enough to the table to be an interesting starter. He brings maybe a little bit more command and control, but is that really, you know, what you need in today's game? I'm not sure, but he's making it work in the fact that he is getting some swing and miss out of what he's doing right now, a little bit more than he's shown in the past. But then again, that cutter is really not too good right now in the small sample that it is. Rodon just has more upside. I think that's the bottom line, kind of what I'm getting at. And Musgrove going to Pittsburgh, there's always that narrative that, you know, Pittsburgh is an exciting place for pitchers since we're talking about narrative. But I don't know if it is. I mean, is it really an exciting place for pitchers? You know, have you really wanted to own Ivan Nova since he's gone over there? Have you really even wanted to own anyone other than maybe like Jameson Taillon and Felipe Rivero last year? Chad Kuhl might be their most exciting starter right now. It's not really as good as the narrative makes it out to be. So I'm going Rodon, just a personal preference on the upside.
Do you agree, though, one thing about Rodon is because he was, you know, the elite pitcher taken in the draft that year from the collegiate level and was known for his killer slider already, which that slider, the effectiveness on that slider goes in and out. It really does. And, you know, it's not that it's ever turns into a below average pitch, but that certainly is crutch pitch. That's what everything else sort of feeds off of. But do you agree, Paul, at least with my assessment that the label going in because of his basically his draft status, if he had had three or four bad starts right at the end of his collegiate career, I think we would have a completely different idea in our mind of who Carlos Rodon is.
Yeah, I mean, I think so. Once you get that, you know, that high profile tag on you, it's always gonna inflate your value. But then again, Rodon really hasn't had too much of a chance to fail, whereas Joe Musgrove kind of failed on the biggest stage possible while Houston was trying to make the playoffs, and that is something that kind of hampers his value. And then he moves another team and kind of like gets a restart on everything, and he is a little bit more hyped for, I think, what he did on the Astros. I mean, he was kind of a decent closer for them for a little bit, but I mean, what he showed in the major leagues should have probably dampened his value even more, whereas Rodon really hasn't looked too bad since he's played in the major leagues. Like you said, it's varied, but he has such a small sample, and that slider is ridiculous, and it showed at the big league level too. So that is something that you just hold on to. And since he has such the small sample, he still has that high profile draft pick tag on him, and he hasn't been able to shake it yet. So I think that all goes into it.
All right, Andrew, what's your choice? Would you rather have Joe Musgrove or Carlos Rodon going forward?
Well, I mean, it's a tough choice, right? I mean, Rodon's definitely the sexier of the two. Because of the slider, because of, you know, the pedigree of being, you know, drafted third overall. There's definitely that degree to it, right? He's shown he can strike out major league batters. He's also shown a lot of boom or bust while in the majors. Like Joe Musgrove to me is really interesting in the sense that like he's the coming over from Houston, you're actually seeing like in his pitch usage, like the change in philosophy, like in the exact opposite of what you've seen with Garrett Cole, where he's gone from like last year, Musgrove was 48% fastball, 28% slider, 5% cutter. Now with the and very short sample so far this year, but it's been 53% fastball, 13% slider, 18% cutter. So you've seen like drastic change in pitch usage, which looks like it's, you know, now that we've seen the kind of the two switching organizations, has a lot to do with philosophy. So do I feel like if I'm betting on health, which in this case, because Rodon's has consistently been poor, I'm probably going to take my chances with Musgrove. Not that his is necessarily flawless by any means, but like in that aspect of it, like from a pure fantasy, which one do I want to own? Like that's just the direction I kind of see this as, is like I would rather have Musgrove because he pitches in a better park. And he's got a better track record for at least staying healthy. So that's, I mean, that's kind of where I'm at with it.
Well, to put this in a bit of perspective here, Rodon has his 2016 stint with the White Sox, where his walks per nine were under three. Like, we are basically labeling Matt Boyd as a sort of controlled disaster for his 3.3 walks per nine. But we've had stints over four. We've had, you know, long stints in the 3.5 and above range for Rodon. Now, part of what's going on here is you have one masterful pitch when it's right. And we are leaning on the success of it. And I do think there's a really interesting contrast between Rodon and Musgrove that I wanted to get to, that Andrew led me right into. That's that, okay, if Joe Musgrove has a major league average slider, right, he can actually get more out of the slider by using it less, meaning that because it's a deception pitch, you know, that frequently is thrown outside the zone by the time it gets there, right? The more you surprise the hitter with it, the more likely it is to be effective. Whereas Rodon's slider, when it's on, is like as filthy as basically anybody's slider in the game. So his, he can use a lot more than Musgrove can use his. But there's more than, you know, to use an outdated and maybe even kind of cruel thing, there's more than one way to skin a cat here. And the biggest point that I have is I don't really understand why Fangraphs hates WHIP so much. Like, I understand, you know, them not liking wins. There's a lot of stats I understand them not liking. But when I say that on the major league level, Carlos Rodon's WHIP has been god-awful, it's been god-awful. I mean, we don't really have a sample where we say, oh my gosh, you know, we started to see a bit of what he could be in 2016. But by and large, between injuries and bad control, Carlos Rodon has not been good. And, you know, like people holding on to him all year, like you can bring up Carlos Rodon's name in the middle of a draft and people are like, ooh, yeah, Carlos Rodon, ooh. And I look at these numbers and I say, well, why? Like, how did this happen? Like, okay, you've got one really great pitch. Luis Castillo's got one really great pitch too. But people in their mind think that Carlos Rodon, when he turns it on, he's going to win, you know, he's going to start winning Cy Youngs and he'll start being one of the most dominant pitchers in baseball, right? Luis Castillo, on the other hand, like, people, you know, liked him a lot going into this year, but I think like Carlos Rodon's level of excitement has stayed at Luis Castillo, and we have a much longer track record of failure in Rodon. So I think he's fascinating going forward. For baseball itself, I would love Carlos Rodon to be who we think he could be. But at the same time, for these people who I think are stuck on Carlos Rodon having to be great and, you know, this, that, and everything else, at times once they overdraft him, then I want him to continue failing, which I almost feel guilty about. But it's like, where do you come up with all of this confidence that it's partially in the name? And I wonder how much of that name value comes from the actual narrative that leads up to where he is in the majors now. All right, let's talk about somebody else that I think is really fascinating to speak of a narrative that's happened over a very short period of time. And that is Mr. Bellinger out in Los Angeles, who has now been raking, has been really helping this recent surge that the Dodgers have back into the muddled and underwhelming race that is the NL West. I just want to mention that I think there was an overreaction to Bellinger struggling as such a young player in the playoffs last year. And when he started out struggling this year, I think people wildly overreacted. I never once thought about dropping Bellinger this year. I just didn't do it. But there was a lot of talk about people, and I'm sure in smaller leagues, people dropped Bellinger, which is something you inherently do not do when you take Edwin Encarnacion, because you supposedly realize he's going to struggle. You didn't do it when you drafted Mark Teixeira. So if we believed that 30-somethings were automatically going to bounce back, why do we not believe that a guy in his young 20s is going to work it out, especially when we have a stretch of incredible play from Bellinger to go off of, like he had early last year, in his career last year. The other thing I want to mention is, to be a slow starter, you have to have multiple years in the majors to be considered a slow starter. Well, Bellinger didn't start the year in the majors last year. So we didn't even know if he was a slow starter while people were considered dropping him in smaller leagues. So what's your take, and do you see there's some serious narrative issues going on with Bellinger here, Paul?
Yeah, I mean, with Bellinger, I think the biggest thing is that he is so young, and I think that narrative is kind of empowering, is that, you know, he's just so young, and there's no way he's going to be able to repeat it. See, I told you. People love to say, I told you. And that's the thing. People love to say that Cody Bellinger was taken too highly in drafts. There's no way he's going to see I told you so. But that just kind of prevents them from looking at the stats. Those are the kind of people that will just see someone struggle and be like, oh, see, I was right, like right on top of it. Whereas you don't really see that he's actually improving a little bit against breaking balls, against off-speed pitches, and he is seeing more of both of those. Obviously, they found a little bit of a weakness in his swing, but there's not too much in the profile that says he's struggling all that much against anything. You know, he might be just a little bit worse against everything, but, you know, he's young. And to me, that just means that he should improve if he is as good as we all think he is. So I think that narrative is just a lot about people loving to be right and needing to be right almost in the Twitterverse. And I don't know, you should always be trying to learn a little bit more about the players. I mean, his strikeout rate's a little bit better. Everything is just kind of, you know, there are things that are getting better. There are things that are getting worse, but that is just what a rookie does.
Well, I also find it fascinating. There's so many things I could talk about Bellinger, like them using him in center field regularly. Like, there was originally a thought that maybe he was just kind of a first baseman, but when it was called for, the Dodgers moved him out to center, and seemingly with confidence. Like, yeah, he's very athletic for a guy of his height and a guy with his profile. But I want to talk a little bit about how different his perception went versus Mr. Seager, who played shortstop on the same team. Like, Mr. Seager jumps into the spotlight. And I want to throw out there that because he's a shortstop, we sort of make this assumption that he's going to be, you know, all world all the time, and then he does nothing but struggle for the next couple years. Well, then all of a sudden coming behind him, we have this different profile, this mainly a first baseman who can play a little outfield profile, and that starts to play in our skull, and we start to think, oh, well, you know, Bellinger can't be more valuable than Seager's. Seager's a shortstop, which I don't know. It's just it plays really goofy to me that that's how we feel about it. The other thing that happens is you take a guy who had a stretch where his pitch recognition really, even at the major league level, was good enough for him to thrive so well. Well, when we see him start off the season and his pitch recognition doesn't look as good and his plate discipline is down for 3 weeks to a month, we jump to the conclusion like, oh, well, you know, that was just a mirage that he was good with his pitch recognition last year in his rookie season when he was barely 20 years old, right? Well, the point is that could easily be looked at and said, well, this is a guy who's figured it out before. Like he was selective enough to be drilling pitches. So those are two of the things I want to mention. The other thing I want to mention is that the thing that is most forgotten about a player's eye test, like watching him hit, right, is he smokes the crap out of the ball. Like, I mean, I think you get a lot from watching players. Like, Jesus Aguilar is a guy I picked up in a bunch of leagues. And I picked him up because I saw the Thames injury and, you know, Bron's fragile. You know, he's porcelain to begin with. And it's like, wait a minute. When Jesus Aguilar hits the ball, he smokes the crap out of it. Like, that is something that the eye test has a lot of value in to me. So what do you think about those various points, Andrew? Which ones would you like to hit on?
The comparison to Encarnacion is interesting in the sense that, like, do you think any of the people that are like, Cody Bellinger's done, he couldn't, like we can't wait on this guy. Do you think those are the same, like, what do you think those people had to say about Encarnacion in, like, 2009 when he was left for dead after hitting like 26 home runs for the Reds and then was essentially like a throw-in in a trade for Scott Roland, like there's going to be ups and downs, especially with young players. Like he is only 22 years old. Like he's hot right now. Like he's struggled so far this year. Like a lot of what's hurting his value is a 16% infield fly ball rate, which is double what it was last year. And obviously infield fly balls are more or less outs every time. And I mean, his hard contact is down like 6%, which is a fair bit. And that's all gone over to soft contact. So yeah, you can see why it's not necessarily perfect, but you gotta give him time, and like I definitely get the, you know, we wait for players like Encarnacion because they have a history, and Bellinger just doesn't have the history. So like the way I often see these are buying opportunities, because if the owner is like, oh crap, I shouldn't have, like, why did I get Cody Bellinger, like this guy is trash and we need to move forward, then like it's time to hop in and say, yes, he is trash, but you know, if you know, I've got this other slightly better piece of trash, if you would like to have that, then we can go ahead and make a deal here. Because I mean, the funnest thing about baseball to me sometimes is that like it is a game of averages, and we look at averages for a reason, and it's because in most cases what goes up comes down and what goes down comes up. And I do say this probably way more than I should, but it's true more often than not. Like if you go and you map out their like players' percentages of how much of their season is gained in every single month, it's almost extremely rare that you'll see an even percentage across the board. It's almost always 20% here, 5% the next month, 25% the next month. And it's just it's up and down, and that's the fun thing about baseball is that rarely is anything ever constant for 8 straight months.
All right, let's talk about the underlying story of a breakout candidate that's really coming onto the scene right now. And that's Alan Hansen, who I happened to meet in Philadelphia recently. But there's a few interesting takes here, I think, about Alan Hansen. Number one is, in the age of hyper prospect analysis, I first heard about Alan Hansen about 6 years ago as being a very toolsy kind of guy that was going to, you know, come up and play second base, you know, multiple seasons of, you know, 24 plus stolen bases in the minors on his way up. You know, there's a lot of, Rich Wilson really liked him at Prospect 361. I mean, I saw all this hype about Alan Hansen, and then all of a sudden it was pure fizzle. You know, the Pirates either didn't give him enough time, or they saw enough setbacks in late in his development that they decided that they really were not going to give him a full-blown opportunity. Well, he landed in the land of opportunity for hitting right now, and that's San Francisco, where, oddly enough, now Alan Hansen is a whopping 25 years old. It's got to be just about his prospect. He's got to have, like, almost no shelf life in the bigs if, you know, if by the time you're 25, you haven't completely established yourself, which 7 or 8 years ago, 25 is when a person was first considered for a call-up. And he's having an incredible amount of success, but weirdly enough, the Giants themselves don't appear to always be buying into it, because, you know, they seem to want to give Pablo Sandoval, maybe because they're paying him, you know, maybe because his contract was so huge with the Red Sox or what have you, or a sense of loyalty. They want to give Pablo Sandoval more of a chance to play than seemingly he's worth. But all of a sudden, you look at just results, 5 home runs, 3 stolen bases, 22 games. Is there something to Alan Hansen here, Paul? What do you think?
Yeah, I mean, I really like Alan Hansen. I think that, like you said, the prospect fatigue only kind of, it kind of makes him stand out to me a little bit, because I'm like, okay, why is this guy succeeding now? What did he do? And there's always that narrative to find. So I went searching on YouTube, and I looked at a few of his swings from back in the day, and then I looked at some of the swings that he's had on the Giants, and I could tell that it's a little bit different. He used to coil a lot more, and now it's almost like he's opening his hips really early on, trying to get a little bit more power, trying to get that bat through the zone a little bit quicker so he can hit that high fastball, which he could never get to. And now it seems like maybe he can't hit it. He can't hit it with the best of them. He is still a little bit, you know, struggling against that high fastball. But at the same time, he can get contact on it. And other than that, he's kind of just letting it go. A lot of his walks are taken on high fastballs. And I think that he's realized, you know, I am able to hit it now, but I'm still not the best at it. So all of these things he's putting together with his game are kind of pushing him forward. He's hitting for a little bit more power, and the speed has always been great, like you were saying. So I'm buying into it. I really like what I'm seeing out of Hansen. He's going to have the opportunity in San Francisco. Everything's adding up right now. I mean, this isn't, you know, with 5 home runs already in the bag, he could easily get to 15 and 20, 15, 25 by the time the season's over, just because that speed really hasn't come together yet this season, but it is definitely there.
Well, the other thing to note is that the BABIP doesn't jump off the page. I mean, for a guy that we were not sort of expecting to have this surge of performance, you expect to see a gross BABIP. I mean, not that 340 is, you know, I mean, 340 is on the lucky side, but it's not this gross, you know, 390, 400 BABIP that you just say, well, a speed guy can't possibly be anywhere as close to that. As a speed guy, I mean, he could land in the 320s, which, yeah, I mean, by the way, that 340 BABIP has resulted in a 344 batting average. So anyway, what do you think here, Paul? What are your thoughts? I mean, Andrew, what are your thoughts?
Yeah, I mean, I think Hansen's a perfect guy to pick up in your league if you need steals, right? Like, we all appreciate that steals are hard to find. He's a guy with a 30 plus steal track record in the minors. So, you know, if your team needs speed, and I would, like, typically 50% of every team in your league does, you know, he's worth rostering. I mean, and it doesn't look like it's completely hollow, because at least there's a batting average there, which should continue to lead to more opportunities, as opposed to, you know, holding on to a guy like Michael Taylor, who's got almost 20 steals so far, but is, you know, below the Mendoza line with his batting average. So yeah, I mean, I definitely think there's some lots of reasons to be going out and getting him. Doesn't strike out a ton. So I mean, and when you look at his contact rate, it's, you know, he's making contact just about 80% of the time. So that's the type of guy, when they run well, that are going to get on, that are going to find themselves on base, and accumulating you things like runs and steals. So yeah, I'm in on Alan Hansen.
Well, you know, especially there's a few other things going on here. Like the Giants have, you know, Joe Panik coming back, obviously, and Brandon Belt will be back in time. But they have a relatively wide open lineup. I mean, they've searched for power, just like they've searched for batting average. You know, that Mac Williamson. You know, they have a lot. Gorkys Hernandez has played really above his head, which has led to, you know, better results. Record-wise in San Francisco than most would have thought, considering the pitching injuries that they've suffered through. But I'm really glad that you brought up Michael Taylor, because, like, Michael Taylor has, you know, 20 stolen bases, okay? Well, Michael Taylor is in the opposite situation, meaning that we're wondering if Michael Taylor is going to get sent down or if he's going to get put on the bench. Like, he's had a recent surge in performance that has protected his playing time, but we have to wonder what's happening with Juan Soto and Adam Eaton. And obviously, they're going to run that Harper guy out there on a fairly regular basis while they have him. I have noticed that. They're going to play Harper when he's healthy. I've noticed that for sure. So there's sort of a logjam for playing time around Michael Taylor, who's hitting 200 with 20 steals. And in limited time, and Hansen is just getting back from a DL stint, but he's playing well since he got back. In limited time, you're talking about a three-steal guy for the Giants. But the three-steal guy is going to be playing regularly. I mean, you have to wonder how everything's going to develop in Washington. So there is some compare and contrast here, and it is wonderful to be able to pick up a guy who can help you in speed that's not going to hurt you everywhere else, because as we've seen, you know, even, you know, Trey Turner's had a struggle to keep his batting average where we think it should be. And he's another elite speed guy, which I don't want to make it out to be that Hansen is an elite speed guy yet. We don't know that for sure. I mean, his speed has slowed down some in recent years, but he's got a history of a lot of speed. So a little help for 2-3 week stints in shallower leagues, or the hope that he plays enough third that he ends up third base, second base, and outfield eligible, I mean, has a lot of value too in leagues where versatility comes into play on a regular basis. Let's talk about another guy I'm sort of fascinated by, and that is Lance Lynn, which I believe Paul's probably perfect to talk to about, because he's a guy who's had a decent amount of success and has never really been embraced by the fantasy community as possibly being a really good pitcher. And to add to that, he really struggled this year without a spring training, and now we're seeing a little bit better results. Has your opinion of Lance Lynn turned the corner here, Paul?
I never really liked Lance Lynn, but this year I found myself buying into him a little bit, and I don't really know why. I think I just kind of felt that he was going to bounce back, like you said. I mean, last year there wasn't really too many things that said he was going to be bad this year. I think the worst thing that happened to him was not getting signed right away, and he kind of had a little bit of struggle at the beginning of the season. But I don't know, he's kind of still what he is. I mean, he throws a ton of pitches. The only problem I see right now is that the fastball is going up in velocity a little bit, but it seems to be worse this year. I'm not sure if he's just not locating it well, or if it's just the problem with, you know, like I said, the fact that he kind of missed a little bit of time at the beginning of the year with, you know, not being signed right away. But he could just be changing, maybe throwing some more high heat or something like that. I do think that this is a perfect candidate to kind of turn it around as he gets going into the season, because the velocity is up a little bit. The movement is seemingly up just a little bit. I don't know. It's kind of interesting to me. Lance Lynn has always been interesting.
Yeah, and there is a number of things going on here with the late signing, and also with the fact that, you know, he could be a very rich free agent here if he really turns the whole thing around. So I wonder where are you on Lance Lynn, Andrew?
I bought into Lance Lynn in a couple spots because the price was right. And he has a past history of success. And I think there's still room for Lance Lynn to be a successful pitcher this year. And all of that kind of lies within him finding a way to cut out like 2 walks per 9. Because obviously it's going to be extremely difficult to be successful with a 5.81 walk per nine. So, like, as a pitcher, as a veteran, I mean, this is his, you know, he's a Tommy John survivor. He's kind of made it through what I think of as the worst of it. And some of this could also just be adjustments moving, you know, away from St. Louis to Minnesota, you know, different league. It comes with some different adjustments. So, you know, I think there's still hope that this 5 ERA can drop significantly, probably even past what the FIP and the XFIP think at 4.4. He's giving up probably a little bit more contact than I'd like at, you know, it's happening at a 79% clip. And like, it's an interesting profile. Like, usually I think when I see a really high walk rate, I expect it to come with a really high home run rate. And that hasn't been the case for him so far. You can see that it looks like he is struggling with his control a bit. He's only in the zone 35% of the time. So there's some things to be, there's certainly lots of room for improvement, but he's in a good place to pitch this year in Minnesota. Not necessarily the pitcher's haven that I think people thought it would be, but it is not necessarily the, you know, you're not facing Murderer's Row every night in the AL Central. So, I'm hopeful for Lance Lynn this year.
Well, I mean, the eternal optimist would say, okay, his ERA sits at 5.08 right now. Zips has him projected at the end of the season to get to 4.16. That is a lot of good pitching to take, you know, to take your ERA down almost a point versus what he's been. And I did find Lance Lynn on a couple waiver wires right after his first good start. And it's hard for me to imagine a pitcher who had established himself so much that he was an 18-win guy in 2012, followed by 15 wins, 14 wins, and 12 wins through 2015. You know, he had 11 wins last year. And he also was a guy who pitched a ton of innings. You know, he has to be more efficient. And I saw a number of his bad starts early in the season, and he literally got to the point where he was struggling so bad with his command that you knew he eventually had to groove one, and every time he grooved one, it got parked, which, you know, is going to happen at the highest level in the sport. That is going to happen. So I think, you know, I think Andrew's really onto something, that we need to see this nudge up. And he's never been a control guy. I mean, he's regularly been over 3 walks per 9, but there's a huge difference between, you know, 3.27 walks per nine in 2012 and 5.81 walks in 2018. So if you want to monitor something from afar, as he walks less guys, and when he faces a team that isn't particularly adept at taking walks, those might be, you know, sort of things to look for and to see exactly how that number plays out. Because I think we'll see most of the rest of his numbers fall in line with, you know, with a slight improvement in his control. I wanted to include him here just because I wondered what people would think of the direction that we see recently, which is far better results in his last few starts for a guy who definitely was a good major league pitcher for quite a stretch of time in the not too distant past. All right, let's talk about maybe one of the more fascinating examples of the concept of wondering exactly how we got to a point with a player and where we think he should be now. What is your level of disappointment right now in Alex Bregman, Paul?
I am not too upset with Alex Bregman. I don't know. Should I be? I guess. I don't. I'm not. He's still good, man. I don't know. He's hitting the ball hard. He walks a lot. He doesn't strike out a lot. There's really not much to dislike. All of his whiff percentages are improving against fastballs, breaking balls, and off-speed pitches. This is just kind of, I think we can start tagging Alex Bregman with that slow starter narrative pretty soon if he has a couple more seasons like this, because it seems like he uses this beginning of the season to gather a little bit of a sample size. I mean, Houston is a very advanced developmental team. So if he does gather a little bit more information during the beginning of the season, swings a little bit less, and then kind of unleashes it at the end of the year, I wouldn't necessarily doubt it. He seems like a smart kid, a really good baseball player, and he's proving it again this year that no matter what the numbers say, he still has an... I mean, if you don't like the X stats, it's fine, but... when someone has like a 449 slug and then a 547 X slug, you kind of have to wonder how good can this kid be? I mean, his X slug is almost 100 points higher than his regular slugging percentage. I think we're in for quite the summer from Alex Bregman.
Well, it's going to be very curious to see how it plays out, because I'm getting ready to call him Expectation Boy. I think, you know, there's just been, you know, we're talking about a guy who's never hit 20 home runs.
But what season. Don't you like right now, though, is my question. He has a 380 OBP with 8 home runs and 6 stolen bases. I mean, that's not bad. Is that bad?
Well, what I don't like is I don't like the draft cost. that's essentially what I don't like, which is completely unfair as well. But when you're taking a guy in the third round, right? Like, he needs to be one of the bases for your offense. Okay. And 8 home runs in this day and age, 6 stolen bases. How about the .266 batting average so far? Like, meh. I mean, and is this unfair? I mean, this is part of a story about in narratives too, is how unfair is this for me to think that a 24-year-old who's walking more than he's striking out and on pace for, you know, 20-plus home runs and 20-plus steals, for me to go, Like, I mean, this is part of what builds in over time to a narrative. What Paul is saying is dead nuts true. Alex Bregman is a hell of a major league player at 24 years old. But when I drafted him in the third round, you know, ahead of guys that are really overperforming or what have you, I look at it and I go, really? Like, did I make a mistake in drafting Alex Bregman in the third round? When, you know, I thought, well, I needed some speed and I really wanted, you know, I love the flexibility of shortstop and second base. I mean, what do you think, Andrew? Did I make a mistake in drafting Alex Bregman in the third round? Did drafters in general make a mistake in drafting him that early?
I will say that we made a mistake drafting him in the third round, because I also did it on several occasions. I think I might have even drafted him in the second round somewhere. And a lot of that was I was hopeful of a 25-25 season as a shortstop. What will be interesting for me is to see how Alex Bregman gets drafted next year as third base only, provided Carlos Correa doesn't miss an extended period of time and Bregman remains third base only. Because I think people are going to look at his numbers and say, like, he doesn't hit 30 home runs. I don't want him at third base. Third base has to produce 30-plus home runs. He doesn't do that. I'm moving on. I can see a narrative that leads to Bregman being really undervalued next year. And if that's the case, I will drive that narrative, because I'll love for him to be much less valued next year and get him in, like, the 6th or 7th round. Because what's not to like about 2020 guys that, like... I would love for him to be hitting about 20 points higher in his average. But his OBP is already 20 points higher than it was last year, which is great. And if his average comes up 20 points, that means like he could be at almost 400 OBP. I'm not sure what's not to like about that.
It's so unfair. It's like it's unfair to him as a 24-year-old. The other thing that is really fed this, that fueled this craziness, this Alex Bregman craze, is he's an Astro. I mean, what's not to like about being an Astro? I mean, you know, you got George Springer, you got Jose Altuve, you got Carlos Correa. I mean, your bad hitter is Yuli Gurriel. I mean, and he's still a good hitter. I mean, you know, you got backup catchers who can hit 30 bombs. I mean, what's not to love about being an Astro? But I wonder if the draft hype, you know, really went just a little bit too far. And of course, the other thing that's going on here is that in a batting average league, you say, wow, 266, yeesh, that's not great for a high pick, right? But in an OBP league, you go 375, woo, that's smoking for a 24-year-old. So there's just a lot of things going on with Alex Bregman, and I don't know what the prevailing thought is within the industry. Paul, why don't you chime in with that? What do you think the prevailing thought is on Alex Bregman?
I'm not sure. Like, just what do you think people are going to think about him at the end of the season?
Yeah, and what do you think? I mean, people are going to look back at him as you think they're going to look back at him as a bust? If he doesn't, you know, dramatically pick up the pace?
See, I don't think so. I mean, I really don't. Not everyone can be Jose Ramirez right off the bat. I mean, some people need a little bit of time to get into the season. If that's not, you know, that's not an out of the realm comparison there, I don't think. They both kind of walk just as much as they strike out. Bregman obviously more than he strikes out. They both have like insane plate discipline. Bregman is actually getting better as he swings less. So the less he swings, the better he is, just because he specifies exactly what pitches he wants to hit. I mean, I don't think that it's necessarily the draft hype or the Houston Astros hype. I think it's just that we believe this guy should be an amazing player, and whether he's, you know, a bust or not, I don't think is even in the realm of possibility. I think it's like, you know, is he more Anthony Rendon or is he more Jose Ramirez? Like, is he more of a first round talent or is he more of a fourth round talent? But he's definitely in that range somewhere, and I think that that'll be the prevailing factor or the prevailing thought on Alex Bregman by the end of the year.
Well, it was certainly a case of hyped expectation. There's really no doubt about that. I also want to note that I wonder what his stature plays in all of this, because he's kind of the Mike Trout build of the infield, which, you know, again, when you look at Mike Trout, he maybe doesn't have the most long, lean, athletic, traditional baseball build that we see in the, you know, in the sort of Ted Williams, Dan Musial mode, which is just almost psychotic, isn't it? To think that that's maybe what, you know, you look at Chris Bryant versus Alex Bregman, like you just look at them physically, you know, like my wife thinks Chris Bryant's hot, you know, I mean, tall, thin, blue eyes, this, that, or whatever. Alex Bregman kind of looks like a fire plug, you know, I mean, he doesn't fit a mental idea of what we think a stud baseball player is supposed to look like, which is maybe inherently flawed, and adding to some of the swirling of expectation versus production that's going on here. Alex Bregman obviously is a really good player, and I just sort of wanted to bring up a guy who is really thriving, but maybe you don't quite get the whole thing coming along with it that should be there. You know, you look at him versus Ozzie Albies. There's people who think Ozzie Albies is having a better season than Alex Bregman, and he's not. Right. You know, I mean, you know, I so
handful of home runs is about it.
Yeah. So what is the what drives sometimes the narratives that go on behind what we think about players. That's what I wanted to get to with Alex Bregman, who I think is a wonderful player and is going to have some monster fantasy seasons. So like Andrew got to, if his draft status goes down with people because of him losing multi-eligibility and the shortstop eligibility, I think he is going to be a draft value next year, even though I think there's moments where I wish I had taken a different kind of player within the top three rounds this year, which is wildly unfair. So anyway, I just wanted to have this discussion about how narratives drive what goes on and maybe point to some of the things that I think can be flawed within the narratives with the player list. So Paul, why don't you tell us what you're working on specifically now, or half of what you're working on, since it's frequently so much that we don't necessarily have time for it all. But what are you working on now, and where can you be reached?
Well, my fab piece came out on Razzball yesterday. Prospects of the Week will come out on Prospects 1500 tonight. And you can always just follow me on Twitter at Paul the Martin. It's the best way to get everything that I do. And I'm always retweeting cool stuff, so it's definitely worth it.
Well, I don't frequently, and since we're in the same league, I'm going to mention this, Paul. I don't frequently spend or remember to spend much on Sunday night because it's such a terrible time for me to do Fab. But since you brought up Fab, did you notice that I spent $141 on Frankie Montas? Do you think that's nuts?
I do.
Oh, okay. Simply. I had a lot of money to spend, and I had three pitchers go down last week. And I could be wrong, but Montas seems to be having really good results right now.
I spent over $100 on Domingo Herman, so I'm in there with you, man. I'm holding.
All right. Well, sometimes you draft out of a crazy need. Like you need something that's happening.
A body.
You need something that's happening to be continuing. I don't think Montas is that bad. We're going to cover Montas on the Wednesday show for sure now. So anyway, Andrew, how about you? Any fab stories, and tell us what you're working on.
Well, I continue to have the fab problem of getting overbid or getting outbid, and that in the Battle of the Podcast League, I don't think I got any of my guys this week, and my TGFBI team is just getting just buried by the death of Josh Donaldson, Corey Seager, so on and so forth. And then not getting guys in Fab because I'm continuously getting outbid. That being said, you know, just keep on keeping on at this point. I think it's about time. Things are probably going to get daring for me in TGFBI. But that being said, yeah, not need to get some more baseball writing out there. I haven't put anything out in a couple weeks now. And obviously, you know, doing this podcast with you gentlemen each Monday.
All right, you guys can look for a post for my finally trying to assess exactly how the positions have gone so far this year. You can look for that in the next couple days. I'm Chuck Anderson. I can be reached at Just Chucking It on Twitter. I hope you enjoyed a spirited conversation about narratives and how they play out during the season, and how I think they're a lot of times are inherently flawed. So we will talk back at you next week, Monday. I want to have a special thanks to Paul for filling in late. He just got back from the gym, and we had somebody else who couldn't make it. So, Paul, your input was very much appreciated, and thanks for coming on the spur of the moment. It definitely added very well to our conversation.
Yeah, thanks for having me on, man.
All right. Thanks for everything you do, Andrew, as usual. I appreciate your consistency and professionalism. It makes my job that much easier. Thanks, everyone. We'll be back at you next week. This is a Friends with Fantasy Benefits Concept Pod signing off.